Just because I'm a winemaker doesn't mean I have to be a critic all the time.
Oh, this is fun and it's beautiful. You do it because you love it. And if you don't love it unconditionally and stupidly and you're not crazy passionate about it, you won't last.
You know, to stay out of the vineyard, I only have the shotgun for the boar and I'm thinking, great.
Turning sugar into alcohol is not really rocket science.
You think your car depreciates quickly. Don't hold a candle to what barrels do.
A lot of people don't realize Sonoma County is 1 million acres. Makes us about the size of Rhode Island as a state.
I mean, in my youth, my first couple of vintages, the crazy part was being lucky we're alive still.
The really cool thing about wine is it swims in the stream of history and civilization and everything else.
I worked 14 hours the day before I went into labor. I was determined to get most of that Chardonnay in.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 211. This week we feature Tony Kuyumjun of Montel Winery in Augusta, Missouri. The very first American Viticultural Area, or AVA, to be named in the United States was Augusta, Missouri, even before Napa Valley. Augusta is about 45 minutes outside of St. Louis, and the location of our interview with Montel Winery and Augusta Winery owner, Tony Kuyumjun. Tony is a former commercial airline pilot, and that alone makes for some great stories. We met with Tony at Montel Winery on a fantastically warm day in November to chat about Missouri wine and how a pilot became a winemaker. It's Veterans Day, and this is November, and it's probably about 65 degrees, and I'm in Augusta, Missouri, just outside of St. Louis, with Tony Kuyumjun. That worked. That was better. How you doing, Tony?
I'm doing good.
Thanks for making the time today. When I drove up your winery here, which is beautiful, by the way, on top of this hill, you say about 1,000 feet up, it's packed today, obviously being a holiday for certain people. It's Friday. But again, it's just a stunning, beautiful November day.
Yes, I mean, it's unusual that it would be, we'd have these temperatures. This is coming up on the third weekend in November. Usually we're happy to get one good weekend in November. You know, if we get two, we're really happy. This is going to be three, so.
It's weird.
Yeah, it's very weird, and, you know, it's been sunny, clear skies, light wind. You know, beautiful conditions for people to come out, sit outside, enjoy lunch and a couple of bottles of wine.
So what do we do to deserve this? It's kind of funny.
I don't know. Yeah. You'll have to ask the scientists.
Yeah, well, I know what they'll tell us. So
yeah.
Do you get snow here?
Yes. Yeah. And actually, the temperatures start to change here seriously around Thanksgiving. So, you know, towards the end of this month, December's a cold month, January's a cold month, and then it starts to warm up. We have this phenomena in Missouri that's called the winter thaw, the January thaw, the February thaw.
January.
however you want to think about it. But what happens is we're close to the Mississippi River. We're on the Missouri River, which feeds into the Mississippi. But we're very close to that Mississippi River Valley. And if you get a big low pressure area rumbling across the United States, going across Texas, Oklahoma Panhandle, what it does is it's spinning counterclockwise. So it brings warm, moist air from the Gulf up into this area. And so we'll go from 20 degrees, 30 degrees Fahrenheit up to 60, 70 degrees in the middle of winter. And everybody's overjoyed. They think spring's come, but no. As the low pressure area moves to the east, then the other side of that low pressure area which is spinning counterclockwise, brings the cold Canadian air down. And so we'll go from 65 degrees down to 20 degrees, maybe colder, in a period of 24 hours.
So damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Right.
Yeah, right.
And that is the main reason why we grow very little vinifera grapevines in this area. I knew you were going to ask that question.
I was going to get to that question, but that explains a lot. And climate, you know, one of the nice things is obviously you do get a longer growing season, though, than a lot of areas in the Northeast, I'm sure.
Yes. We have a long, long, warm growing season here with a lot of rain.
Mm-hmm. And let's actually backpedal here. I'm going to kind of get back to the beginning of your story. And just as an aside, before I forget, what is the nationality of your last name?
Armenian. World's first winemakers.
Are you first generation, or were you born there? Or?
Second generation. My father was born here, and I'm the second generation. My son would be the third generation. He also works for the winery.
So was wine in the family from your dad?
From my grandmother. She was a vineyardist. She owned a vineyard in California.
Okay.
So she came over. She immigrated in 1915. It was a forced immigration. And she settled in close to Fresno in the San Joaquin Valley, the Central Valley. And she did what a lot of the other Armenians in that area were doing, and she grew grapes. And the area that she was from in Armenia was a grape-growing area. So she started out the vineyard. My father worked it. I was at the vineyard, obviously, and I saw what they were doing, but I never actually worked the vineyard. I decided to go a different direction.
I want to come back to that in a minute, but she came over in 15, you said?
Yeah.
I mean, she got into it pretty quickly, or...?
She got into it immediately, you know, because that's what her people were doing, you know. And she did have, her sisters were already there and her brother was there.
So that was right around Prohibition time. How were they surviving?
It was right before Prohibition, but what they did is they grew predominantly a grape called Thompson Seedless. Okay, so Thompson Seedless can be used for table grapes, it can be used for raisins, or it can be used for wine. The reason why they grew that grape was because they could switch markets, you know. So if raisin prices were down, they'd grow them as table grapes.
So you said you went a different direction in terms of?
I saw what farming was like from the grounds up, and it's not as romantic as you would think. Even grape growing isn't all that romantic. You're reliant on the weather. You're reliant on rainfall and temperatures and everything else. So I had an interest in aviation. So I studied to become an airline pilot and went to work for TWA. And so I left California, came to St. Louis, and I started flying initially domestically, and then I moved to New York and flew to Europe, Western Europe and the Middle East.
Wow. And how long were you a pilot before you decided to, you know, move into something different here?
27 years.
Wow, that's impressive. Very cool. You must have seen some very interesting moments.
We went through a lot of different things, you know, from the collapse of the Berlin Wall to 9/11.
What year was it you started flying?
I started flying in 65.
Wow. You saw an entire industry completely change.
Yeah.
That's pretty damn cool.
Yeah, everything. And actually, that's one of the reasons I stopped flying, was because of the changes in the industry. You know, terrorism changed things a lot. And, 9/11 changed everything very drastically. And it got to the point where pilots were treated, almost like terrorists. You had to go through the same screening as everybody else, and only you had to do it several times a day.
Technology changed, so completely differently for airliners, especially when you're talking about 65, compared to what it's been around the time you stopped. I mean, was that something that was also a challenge for you to want to continue in the business because of that, the lack of the actual being able to fly?
Well, you know, that was part of it. I mean, it was interesting going through the industry at the time when I went through it, because you went from propeller-driven airplanes to jet engines, you know, high bypass fan engines, and then, you know, the technology of automation and, you know, I mean, it in a way it took away some of the fun. It took away some of the independence that you had, because when we used to cross the ocean, we were dealing with very old technology, and in fact, you know, we'd use high frequency radio communications, and a lot of times you would not even have communication. If you know, if the atmosphere wasn't just right, you wouldn't have communications, and you just continued doing what you're doing and navigating across the ocean, and you know, making sure that you're on the checkpoints and everything like that. And then when you got back into radio control, it was fine. But you know, you felt like you were real independent for periods of time, and you know, you weren't you know, having to speak to people and tell them where you were and what you're doing and everything like that.
Do you still fly at all?
No.
No? Okay.
No, I enjoyed my flying career, but when I stopped flying commercially, I just stopped flying. And in addition to that, you know, one of the reasons I didn't retire because of age, I retired early because I was so much more fascinated with the winemaking and the grape growing aspect.
So you had, obviously, your grandmother, her involvement back then, but was there something along the way that made you get into it? Did you meet somebody, drink a wine, whatever it might be?
Well, I think what got me, you know, if there's an epiphany moment, you know, it was when I was flying in Western Europe. And, you know, in the old days of flying, you'd actually fly over to Paris or Frankfurt, and you'd have 2 days off. And so what I always enjoy doing is, you know, I mean, initially you'd want to visit the sites in the town. But then after that, I wanted to get out in the countryside. And I enjoyed wine anyway. And so I wanted to taste the wines in these little villages that I'd only heard about, you know, reading. And it was amazing because you'd go to one village and you'd taste their wines, and they were very proud of their wines, and they said, you know, we make the best wines in the world, you know. And then you'd go 3 kilometers and they'd say, well, we make the best wines in the world, and this is why. And I said, well, you know, that's funny. I was just over at such and such a town, and they said they made the best wines in the world. No way, you know. And these wines were all a little bit different. You know, I mean, some of it had to do with the soil. Some of it had to do with the exposure to the sun. You know, the slope on the vineyards, where it was in relation to the ocean or to a river. But a lot of it was just these people have been making wines there for 1,000 years, and it was passed on from one generation to another. And, you know, the times that I was visiting these vineyards, the technology was just starting to change as far as winemaking and grape growing was going.
What year would that have been roughly when you started?
So that would have been in the 70s.
Okay.
And prior to that, especially in Europe and France and Germany and Spain and Italy, things were done in a classic manner. You know, it was passed on from one generation to another. You know, in France or Germany, if you don't own ground, you're not going to be able to buy it, you know, not very easily. So these vineyards were passed on, and so was the way to do it. And it wasn't so much as a scientific method. It was more of a tasting and looking and feeling, and having done it the same way year after year after year, they had it down. They didn't have the science down, but they had the winemaking down.
A lot of heart and soul.
Exactly. And each wine was a little bit different. You know, I mean, it wasn't where people were trying to design a wine that everybody in the world is going to like. they were trying to design a wine that everybody in that village was going to like. And they were going to like because, you know, I mean, globalization hadn't really started very much. And so their markets were all local. And they had to please the local people. And they built a brand over, you know, hundreds of years and continued to make wine that way.
And you got to peek in on what was going on.
Exactly. And it was fascinating. You know, I mean, and to taste wines that were all a little bit different, you know, and that's what fascinated me. Not making a wine in an industrial fashion, you know, where it tastes the same year after year after year. It's, you know, going with the change in the vintage and, you know, just making a wine that's totally unique.
So after this time, you know, you had this great experience, which I would have given my left leg to be able to experience what you did. So was it in your head, you know, I really would like to learn this and do this myself?
It was a fascination, and I never really thought that I could do it. You know, I mean,
fascinations are dangerous.
Yes, I know that. And you know, I could have moved back to California, but that was problematic at the time. So what happened? I guess it was just blind luck. But about the same time that I started to get excited about, you know, these different wines, they also started a rebuilding of the Missouri wine industry because it was decimated by Prohibition. And the people that were in California, I think, were more forward-thinking than the people in Missouri. And they realized that, you know, this wasn't going to be forever. You know, Prohibition wasn't going to last forever. And if you know the history of California winemaking, essentially during Prohibition, what most of the wineries did and the vineyard owners is they shipped the grapes to the East Coast where they made wine out of it. You know, people made wine in their basements and probably illegal wine other places and stuff like that. But they never stopped growing their grapes. They never ripped out their vineyards. In Missouri, the Germans were the ones that were making the wine. They were the ones that were growing the vineyards. And they came to Missouri, they came to the United States for freedom from not only from religious constraints, but also from political restraints. And they come here, they build up these beautiful businesses and huge wineries and huge vineyards, and then they're told that they have to dump it all, that they can't continue to sell this wine. And I think it was a kind of a knee-jerk reaction, and they just ripped up the vineyards and really they didn't think about the fact that, hey, you know, we could maybe sell this to people and they could make their own wine. They just got mad and got rid of the vineyards, and they turned the wineries into mushroom cellars, and they grew mushrooms down there and stuff like that. And so it wasn't until the 60s that there was a resurgence of winemaking in Missouri. And at the time, really, the only grapes that were being grown here were the American grapes, the Labrusca grapes, and they were used predominantly for making juice. So, you know, Concord grape juice, Catawba grape juice, Niagara grape juice, you know, processed by Welch's and sold all across the United States. So when the wineries started up again, the only grapes that were available were these juice grapes, which you can make wine out of, but they're not really well suited for that purpose. And so the beginning of this resurgence was kind of these sweeter Labrusca type wines, which a lot of people liked, but it wasn't the direction that I wanted to go. Shortly after that, they started importing grapevines from France that were hybrid grapevines. So they were grapes that were cross-pollinated from American grapes and vinifera grapes. And this all happened right around the time of the Phylloxera epidemic in France, so the turn of the century. And they produced some fabulous grapevines there during this period of time. It was like scientists being able to do whatever they wanted to do. And they said, you know, if we're going to do this, if we're going to create a grapevine that's going to be resistant to phylloxera, we want to do some other things too. We want to produce a grapevine that is resistant to pests. We want something that doesn't get powdery mildew and downy mildew. And so they were breeding disease resistance into these grapevines. They were also trying to produce wines, grapevines that produced economically a favorable amount of grape per acre, and you know, something that would produce a good tasting wine. So they produced all these grapevines, and you know, there was thousands of them, and they weeded them down to maybe a few hundred, and then they came up with a different idea on how to prevent phylloxera, and that was grafting the vinifera canes onto the American rootstock. And why they didn't try that initially, you know, is baffling to me, but they didn't.
So. I think sometimes the most obvious things are the things you don't try.
Exactly. So in and around the 60s is when the French said, we no longer have any use for these hybrid grapes. Anybody that wants them can come and get them. And they started being imported into the United States. And what we found out in the Midwest and also on the East Coast, probably the East Coast first and then the Midwest, was that these grapes are, number one, resistant to disease. So if you're in a humid area, you don't have to worry too much about, you know, powdery mildew, downy mildew, stuff like that. The other thing is that they're slower to react to changes in temperature. So they don't bud out as early as vinifera would. And going back to my story about the low pressure area going across the Texas and Oklahoma panhandle, vinifera grapes, when they feel that first warmth after a period of dormancy, will start to bud out. Sap flows up through the trunk and into the canes and the buds, and things start to grow. And then the cold snap comes, and not only does it kill those buds, but it kills the entire plant. So vinifera is not a, I don't think it's a possibility for commercial winemaking, you know, on very limited basis. It works. There's certain varieties that we've found that do fairly well, and you know, as long as we don't have these cold snaps, they'll do okay. But the hybrids seem to be really well suited, and the wine that's produced by the French American hybrids, and now even some of the second and third generation hybrids, which were crossing vinifera back again to these hybrids, I think produce wines that are really nice. For sure, they're better than the wines that are produced from vinifera.
How did you end up beginning to do this? And I'm assuming a lot of this is why you chose to make Missouri your home.
Right. So there was a when this resurgence started, there was a lot of money available to you know, educate yourself. So that, there was a lot of seminars. There was a lot of people that were coming in from California, from all over the world, to help us learn, you know, about winemaking and grape growing and stuff like that. And so I really got involved in that. I took as many courses as I could. Went to California, took some courses, more or less short courses, dealing with specific areas of winemaking. And I started looking at a place to build a winery and plant grapes and stuff like that. And when I looked at the, you know, the price of land in Missouri as opposed to the price of land in California, it was a no-brainer. I didn't have the money to start a winery in California.
Few people do.
Yeah. Mm. So, and at that time I was, you know, more or less just starting out as a airline pilot, and I wasn't making that much money, and you know, didn't have a huge business that I could sell. So that's what I decided to do, and it was, and not only that, but it was the challenge. You know, it was. You know, I really think that we can make good wines with the grapes that can grow in Missouri. I think that, you know, the Norton grape, or the Cynthiana grape, as it's sometimes called, had a lot of potential. You know, I mean, I tasted the early wines that were made from these grapes. And I thought, you know, if somebody worked on this a little bit more, they could produce something really nice. And, you know, the French-American hybrids were producing fairly nice wines. And so I decided to give it a go, you know. I mean, try to make something out of an emerging wine area.
What year was that?
So I opened up my first winery in 1980.
So this is not your first winery?
This is not my first winery. This is actually my third winery.
Oh, your third winery. Well, we were talking before, while we were at Montel, you also owned the Augusta Winery as well,
right? That's correct. That was my second winery. My first winery was a winery in St. Charles.
Oh, okay.
St. Charles, Missouri.
Again, Montel, which is where we're at today, is your third winery. And so I'm assuming, based on your success at Augusta, you decided to push yourself a little further.
Well, the winery in Augusta I built from the bottom up, and it was a lot of work, and you know, I was constantly improving. And then about 10 years later, the couple that owned Montel Winery said that they felt like they needed to retire, you know, as they said, for the second time, and they wanted to know if I would like to buy it. And they said, we don't want to sell to just anybody. We want to sell it to somebody that we know would make good wines and would continue the legacy, you know. And so we negotiated for quite some time and finally came to an agreement.
What year was that?
This was in 98. And so I bought it in the fall of 98. And, you know, I've made a lot of improvements here. You know, I mean, added terraces, expanded the winemaking process, modernized the winemaking process, and we've been concentrating on the quality of the wine, but also on customer service.
Well, it's a beautiful space. It's a very large space, but it doesn't feel massive. The view here, again, we'll have some shots with the video that will show. Definitely very high on the list, easily in the top five wineries I've ever been in terms of beautiful view. But in regard to the wines, are you the winemaker then?
I'm the winemaker emeritus. My son has taken over the winemaking, and I'm concentrating more on running the business and expanding the vineyards.
How old is your son?
What is he, 36?
Tell me about the wines that you're making. I've looked at a few. Chardonnay was one of them, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
Why don't you walk through a list of these for me?
Okay. Well, let's start out with the Chardonnay. We really love that grape. This is, again, one of those second-generation hybrids, okay? So it's a hybrid between Sauval Blanc, which is a French-American hybrid,
sure, yeah,
and Chardonnay. So it was crossed a second time. And I love the way the grape grows. One thing that we found out that most of our hybrid grapes were growing on their own roots, but the second generation hybrids you can't grow on their own roots because they are not resistant to phylloxera. So we learned that the hard way. And so now all our Chardonnay vines are grafted. And it produces a wine very much characteristic to Chardonnay. We make it in a lot of different styles. We make a Burgundian style, so fermented in the barrel, goes through malolactic in the barrel. We also produce a stainless steel version that's, you know, very crisp accenting the fruit and the minerality, and just a nice, easy sipping, moderately priced wine.
Sure. Well, that's the nice thing about coming to a winery like this too, versus being in somewhere like Napa Sonoma. You're talking about some wonderful prices. I mean, you know, this is something where buying a case isn't going to kill you.
Right. Well, our average bottle price here at Montel is $12.
Yeah.
So.
That's such a pleasure to hear.
Yeah, and that's buying it at the winery and consuming it at the winery. So, this is part of our business strategy is to produce wines at a moderate price that people don't have to think twice about. And they can walk out with two or three cases rather than walk out with one bottle.
Sure. Do you ship out of state at all? Are you allowed to do that?
Yes, we can ship. We have an internet website, obviously, and so people can order from the website. We distribute to two states other than Missouri, and that's Illinois and Arkansas. And we find that distributing through these three states is enough for our production.
And about how many cases are you doing? Speaking of production,
we're about 45,000 cases.
That's pretty good size.
Yeah,
I mean that's considered small as the world turns, but in terms of small wineries, that's good sized.
It's for us. It's something that we can manage, and we change our strategic plan or we revisit it every 5 years and tweak it a little bit. And what we decided on the last go around, which was 2 years ago, that we were going to cap our production at 50,000 cases. Because what we were starting to see is that as the production was increasing, it was getting more and more difficult for us to manage it within the family.
Sure.
And we didn't want to hire a winemaker or general manager or, somebody that would just kind of take over and we'd pay him to do the job. We wanted it to be done within the family. And
you wanted to have the purple hands.
Yeah.
Yeah. And as I came up, the drive up here was extraordinary. I didn't see any vineyards near here. Where are the vineyards for the grapes you're growing?
The vineyards are all set back in small parcels, really. We have our estate vineyard amounts to about 70 acres. But it's not all in one spot. It's over a 500-acre farm.
Sure, sure.
Because in this area, you have to pick the very best location, and if you don't, you're not going to make good wine.
And that could get really expensive.
Exactly. And the other thing is that we don't use water for frost prevention. We use the terrain itself. So, we're up fairly high, generally in the 800 foot above sea level to 1,000 foot above sea level range. And if we have a problem with a winter frost, generally all that cold air settles down into the Missouri River Valley.
So it's kind of Mother Nature taking care of itself.
Exactly. That's nice. And so you have to have an area that has a moderate slope, and it has to also have free channels where the air, cold air will flow down into the river valley. And so therefore, we save a lot of money worrying about frost protection.
Is everything you're bottling, is it all estate, or do you buy fruit otherwise?
We buy about 10% of our production.
That's still impressive.
Yeah, but most of it's estate bottled. We're working towards that day where it's going to be 100%. From our own vineyard. So that's one of my jobs, is expanding the vineyards and picking out new varieties or varieties to plant and locations to plant them in. And as long as we can produce more wine, get up to that 50,000 case limit, then we'll continue to plant more vineyards until we are self-sustaining.
Sure. Yeah, then you're independent.
Right.
For our listeners, and obviously your tasting here, I'm assuming people could just drive up. They don't necessarily have to make an appointment.
It's a very casual environment here. People don't have to make a reservation. They drive up, they park their car, they walk in, they can do their wine tasting, buy a bottle of wine, sit out here, listen to music, enjoy the outdoors, and It's a great way to spend a day.
Yeah. Well, and on top of that, the drive up here is just worth it alone because it's when you get up here, you get to see this view, and it was just a fun drive. For our listeners who'd like to learn a little bit more about you online, how would they find out about you, your website?
It's AugustaWinery.com or Montel.com.
And again, your wineries are within, what, about 5 miles of each other?
Yes.
10, something like that. So anybody can come visit here anytime. Are you open year-round?
We're open year-round, and, we keep normal business hours. We open at 10, and then we close at 5:30 during the week and stay open till 6. Off-season, during the season, we're open till 10 o'clock on Saturday and 9 o'clock on Friday. So we have what we call sunset dinners, which are really cool because you sit out on one of the terraces right behind you and face west, and we have white linens and china and silverware, and the waiters come out and serve you in courses, and you watch the sunset as you're sipping wine and eating great food.
That's cool. Well, this would be a great place to do it. Tony, I know you're busy. You got a lot going on here today with the holiday. I can't thank you enough for making the time and sitting down and chatting with us.
No, it's my pleasure. Stop by again.
I will definitely do that. Cheers.
Cheers.
Learn more by visiting Montel.com or AugustaWinery.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Web design by Jenny Holland. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Photos by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2016.